Hello, and welcome to Community Conversations. These are pre-recorded interviews brought to you each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. on KRFY. Because of ongoing concerns about the COVID pandemic, we are not able to be in the studio doing live broadcast interviews right now. But we are still dedicated to recording and bringing to you topics of local and current interest, highlighting voices from our community. For Community Conversations, we are using phones and web-based technology so that participants can be recorded remotely. Please bear with us if there are any gaps or hiccups that might be caused by a slow or unstable phone or internet connection. Also, keep in mind that because these interviews are recorded, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that you hear it broadcast. Thank you for joining us for today's Community Conversation on KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. Now grab a cup of coffee, sit back and enjoy some more of Adventure Number 8 by Jim Chappelle, and then we'll get on with today's show. Good morning, and welcome to another edition of Community Conversations with Phil Huff and my co-host, Julie Kellermine. Good morning, Julie.
Hello, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Good. It's Friday, and here we are. Yes, and we are beginning another Community Conversations. I was going to ask you, what's been new in your world? Anything fun and outdoors?
Well, I'm loving the dusting of snow on top of the peaks. It contrasts nicely with all the golds and reds and colors turning, and it definitely feels like fall.
Very true. And a week ago, I was talking fishing, and I was fishing. I was fishing high mountain lakes. And then, of course, what you just mentioned happened, snow on the mountaintops and rain down here in the valleys. And I feel like moving on to mushrooming, which I've been doing a little bit of. However, before we can talk mushrooming, we've got to go back a bit because we scheduled a fisheries update that's going to happen today. And we're so lucky to be joined by Andy Ducks, who is the Regional Fishery Manager here at Idaho Department of Fish and Game. Hello, Andy.
Hi, how are you, Julie and Phil?
Really good.
Morning, Andy.
Glad to have you here. You know, so many topics with Idaho fisheries, and sometimes we try to cover every single one. Today, we're going to try and narrow it down to just a few. And one of those is the Fish and Game stocking program all over the state, but with focus on mountain lakes. I've been up and around the mountain lakes this summer. Phil is always up and around mountain lakes, not always fishing, but he was as curious about it as I was. In fact, he suggested the topic. So I think it would be fun to start with that after we get a little bit of background on about you, what exactly your work is and how long you've been with Idaho Fish and Game.
Well, yeah, I guess a little bit of background. Like you mentioned, I'm the regional fishery manager here in the Panhandle. Been in that role for about 5 years now, I guess, but have been working here in the region for 12 years. And yeah, I guess my role currently is to oversee our fisheries management program here in the region. And we've got a lot of staff doing a lot of different things. And bottom line, our role is to manage the resources for the public and ultimately make fishing better for folks.
So how did you get interested in fishing as a job, a career?
Well, I guess from an early age, it just sort of was something that captured my attention. I'm from Idaho, grew up in Idaho, and a family that did a lot of fishing and other outdoor activities, and it just sort of is lifestyle I've always known, and was drawn to it as a career, I guess. And yeah, it's been a good one, and I really enjoy it.
Yeah, and you've moved up through the ranks, and you manage quite a few people with Fish and Game. How many folks are you managing generally in the fishery department?
Well, directly, our fisheries management group itself is fairly small. I have three folks that I directly supervise that are in our management program, but we also have a whole host of other folks that I'm working with very closely. We have research programs that are dedicated to Lake Ponderay and the Kootenai River. So in total, I actually can't tell you the number of fish staff we have here in the office, but it's probably in the neighborhood of 15 folks, maybe somewhere in there.
Yeah, that's quite a few for our region. I think you must feel lucky to be in your position. So many people come to Idaho Fish and Game from other states, and they'll tell us it's a dream job. So feather in your cap to be here and be able to live here where you grew up.
Yeah, well, great. Idaho's definitely a great state, some great resources. So it's definitely a privilege to be able to work with resources like we have.
And there's so much great fishing here. And as Julie suggested at the beginning, there's a lot of topics we've covered on past shows. And today I think we want to zero in on some of the things we've not touched on before, particularly with regards to high mountain lakes and stocking programs and challenges and opportunities there.
You bet. Yeah, be happy.
Yes, let's just jump in. Well, first of all, let's just start with a general description of what Idaho Fish and Game does with mountain lakes, and go from there.
Sure. Well, it's certainly an important part of our statewide management program. Idaho has an awful lot of mountain lakes. Really, every region in the state has quite a few, some more than others. Certainly, the regions in central Idaho have the most, but we have our fair share up here. And I think statewide, we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 3,800 mountain lakes. And I believe in the panhandle, we're somewhere just shy of 90 mountain lakes. So quite a few of them.
They're not all stocked, are they, though? Some are and some aren't, and they're all stocked differently. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, there's a fair bit of variation. And I guess maybe as a starting point, something important to understand is, you know, historically, before, you know, any kind of fish stocking took place, the vast majority of mountain lakes in the state were fishless. So these are places that native fish historically would have had a difficult time ever colonizing, because these lakes are at high elevation and quite often have like really high gradient streams that lead to them, that often have waterfalls or other passage barriers that historically fish never were able to get above. Or they're mountain lakes that are just they just sit in these high basins and maybe don't have an outlet that really connects, that a fish can colonize that lake. So historically, these were mostly these high elevation puddles of water, so to speak, that certainly supported life like amphibians and other invertebrates, but oftentimes not fish. And so over time, there's been stocking that's occurred. A lot of these lakes have had fish in them for, you know, many, many years now. And there's been kind of a varied stocking history. So we still, now we're left with, you know, some of these lakes that have fish in them that were stocked originally, you know, maybe even 100 years ago, and they've naturally reproduced and sustained themselves. There's other lakes that are dependent on periodic stocking, and if we didn't stock them, you know, natural reproduction may not occur, and so that's how we're able to sustain a fishery there. And then there's other lakes that we don't stock, either because they frequently winter kill, and it's just not a good use of hatchery resources, or to leave a certain proportion of those lakes fishless, so that things like, you know, native amphibians and whatnot are able to still be on the landscape, because there can be negative interactions between stocked fish and for instance amphibians.
Such as in getting eaten, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
So there's been enough of a history where over, say, the last 100 years, hopefully we've been able to chart where the most negative consequences are and gain a better understanding of that. that has to be one of the challenges of the program, managing the additional resource for sportsmen versus the impact on native habitat.
Yeah, and I think that's really one of the challenges to the program, and ultimately what we try to do is provide a balance there where we can provide that recreational opportunity, because certainly mountain lakes are hugely popular with anglers, and that's something that people highly value. So we're trying to provide those opportunities, but at the same time, doing what we can to make sure that we can keep some of these, you know, native species on the landscape, whether those are amphibians or other native fish that may exist either in a mountain lake and have always been there, or in a downstream tributary that, you know, we don't want to have non-native fish trickle down lower into a drainage and have negative interactions with native species. So we're constantly trying to balance that, I guess.
So it sounds like you have quite a few things that you're thinking about when deciding whether to stock a mountain lake. And is there a preference for our native trout or not necessarily?
Well, it definitely varies. We, like I said, we try to, in any instance where a native species has always occurred in the mountain lake, we try to manage in a way that's going to allow that population to be sustained. But as I mentioned earlier, most of these lakes historically were not occupied by native fish. So that has given us a little more latitude to use multiple different species, because historically, if, you know, native fish weren't there, anything we've introduced over time or more recently is essentially non-native to that water body. So that gives us an opportunity to kind of, A, try to use a species that's going to do well in a mountain lake. And so that often leads us to a species like in our area, West Slope cutthroat trout is one of the most common fish that we stock, because they're native to the area, and that is a fish that typically does well. But we also try to diversify these lakes and give people some different opportunities. So there's a few lakes we stock other species of fish in, like, you know, rainbow trout is somewhat common, but even more uncommon, I guess, we've got a handful of lakes where we stock Arctic grayling and golden trout.
Yeah, earlier, just this last week, Bill Love wrote a very nice article for our local newspaper about high mountain lakes stocked with Arctic grayling, and touched on that it was one of a diverse set of species for those opportunities. I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, and it's not something that we do on a widespread basis, because there's challenges in the hatchery environment itself. It's far more cost effective and efficient for us to primarily raise, you know, one or two species instead of having a whole suite of different species. There's a lot of logistical challenges there, but we do have the ability to raise at least small numbers of some of these fish, like Arctic grayling, golden trout, that can get stocked out in a few places just for that diversity and give people a unique opportunity. A lot of folks have never seen an Arctic grayling, and so the idea that you can go on a hike in the Selkirks and go to Long Mountain Lake and catch a grayling, like I think Bill's article highlighted, is pretty cool for a lot of people.
It was pretty cool, and I'm going to add that I was up there with my husband last week, and we had that experience, and it capped off a fun summer of mountain lake fishing for us, because we had an opportunity this summer, Andy, to catch a golden trout, a brook trout, rainbow trout, a cutthroat, and an Arctic grayling. So it was quite an exciting summer for mountain lake fishing. And I've got to, you know, say hats off to Idaho Fish and Game to provide that opportunity.
Well, we're glad you were able to get out and enjoy that.
It's pretty neat. So I wanted to ask you, I'm just wondering, what is the process from the hatchery to the mountain lake? I'm sure it's different from lake to lake. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it does vary a little bit, and it even can vary a little bit around the state. But, you know, typically, I guess at the early phases of this, we have to have a brood stock. And so we've got brood stock, meaning we've got a group of adult fish that we can collect eggs from, spawn those fish that then provide the offspring to raise in the hatchery up to, you know, whatever size we need to before we then transport those fish to the lake. Typically for mountain lakes, most of the stocking is getting done real early. We don't raise fish to real large sizes. We're usually stocking them out at what we call fry stage, which is usually a fish that's only, you know, a couple inches long or fingerling, which is, you know, less than, certainly less than 6 inches long, but usually it's these really small fish that are just a matter of a couple inches long. In the panhandle, we're stocking most of our lakes just by backpack, actually. So we'll have staff carrying a backpack full of water with, you know, a number of these, like for a cutthroat stocking event, have a backpack with a bag full of water and a whole bunch of real small little cutthroat fry, and hike those up to a lake and release those. In other parts of Idaho where lakes are even more difficult to access than what we're typically dealing with, the common stocking method is usually by fixed wing airplane, believe it or not. So these planes will fly at, you know, low level over these lakes, and the fish will literally get dumped out the door of the plane over top of the lake. And that's a really effective strategy because there's so many lakes that we stock, and it's just hard to hike to a lot of those efficiently.
So is that like a bombing run? They take a dive and the hatch door opens and it's bombs away, or?
It's not a true, like, you know, belly dump like you do with a fire retardant plane or whatnot. It's more, they're just getting, you know, dropped out the window, but it's essentially the same thing. They're getting dropped just out the door and splashed down into the lake. So it's pretty neat when you're up in the mountains and you see one of these planes come flying through and a bunch of fish out the door.
I remember years and years ago reading, I think it was in National Geographic, about a doctor's relief aid group in Africa who used fixed wing airplanes and used centripetal force, the opposite of centrifugal force, where inside of the airplane circle, they drop something almost straight to the ground on a very steady manner. So there's a pro tip for maybe the next stocking program.
Gotcha. Yeah, all I know is it involves some pretty fancy flying to, you know, watch these planes come into these high mountain basins at low elevation, and it's pretty cool technique.
Well, I have to say, it sounds like a fun job. I bet Phil would be willing to volunteer for fish delivery via backpack. It's one of his favorite things to do.
Or take
unless
out.
It's, yeah. Yes, there and, you go.
And there are a few places where we do stock larger fish, and those typically are mountain lakes where there's actual road access to, where we can get a stocking truck. And typically those are lakes that see higher amounts of fishing pressure. So one that comes to mind, like, is Antelope Lake above the town of Clark Fork. You can drive to Antelope Lake, and so we will actually stock larger, like what we call catchable fish that are like 10 or 12 inches in length when they get stocked into the lake. So there's a few opportunities like that, but usually it's smaller fish.
Okay. I have another question about the stocking this summer anyway, and maybe every time I've been to a mountain lake, it seems to be one species in the lake. Is that typical?
It's pretty common. And I guess for a couple of reasons, one is, you know, there's a lot of mountain lakes where, you know, we will see a species that's able to successfully reproduce. And so if that's the case, they're really, generally isn't a need for us to go in and stock that lake. So whatever species tends to be doing well there, commonly that'll be east, like a brook trout lake. They're pretty adept at spawning in these mountain lakes if there's any kind of a inflow or an outflow. They need flowing water to spawn in. But there's plenty of lakes too where cutthroat and other species will reproduce. And then if it's a lake that doesn't have natural reproduction that we stock, again, it's back to just the efficiencies of it, and stocking one species is typically more advantageous from that standpoint. And it kind of minimizes the potential for, you know, competition between species that can make these lakes a little harder to manage. So they're typically pretty simple systems, and sort of the simpler we can keep them, that usually is helpful.
So what's the impact on bag and size limits? Do they vary lake by lake or species by species? How does this play into that?
Well, we don't have very many lakes that in the state that have what we call special rules. Most of them are managed under our general fishing rules. So for trout, that's a 6 fish limit, but there's an exception for brook trout. You can keep 25 brook trout. So there are a few lakes in the state that are managed under a special rule that has, you know, some kind of a reduced bag limit or a length limit. But in the panhandle, I think everything that we have as a mountain lake is just a general condition.
What about the cutthroats in the mountain lakes? We have so many places where we're not allowed to catch and keep cutthroats in our state.
Sure. And there's certainly plenty of examples in the panhandle where cutthroat are managed under catch and release rules. And that's typically in places where they are native. So places like the St. Joe River, for example. But in Mountain Lakes, again, these aren't places where cutthroat have native populations. And most of these are stocked fish, which we're putting fish out there to try to give people an opportunity, not just to catch a fish, but be able to cook one up.
Yeah, it makes me encouraged to want to bring my frying pan the next time I'm up there. Andy, help us with this question around the size of fish in some of the mountain lakes. Sometimes you'll fish a lake and there are plenty of big ones, and sometimes they're all tiny. What you've told us is sometimes you're stocking little ones, but it's not always just that, is it?
Yeah, there's a lot of variables there. You know, we commonly will have like brook trout populations are very adept at reaching high density. And when you have more fish in a lake, more mouths to feed and a limited number of groceries to go around, so to speak, it tends to limit growth. And so you can end up with these stunted populations at a lot of lakes where you have a whole lot of fish out there. You might be catching fish on nearly every cast, but they may only be 6 inches long. You go to other lakes where maybe there isn't natural reproduction and it's only fish that are being stocked that are populating that lake. So we can regulate density by how many fish we put in the lake. If we keep density of fish a little lower, there's more resources, more food for those fish. They have an ability to get bigger. And other factors are, you know, where's the lake located? There's really high elevation lakes that have a really short growing season because they may have ice on them into July, and it's cold again in these places by September, so that doesn't give a fish a lot of time to grow. Other places where mountain lakes are maybe a little lower elevation or a different aspect where they get a little bit more sun and have a longer growing season, you know, things like that certainly influence how big fish get in these lakes. That's kind of the fun of mountain lake fishing too, is they're so variable that, you know, you might be able to fish half a dozen lakes in a day if you go to a certain area, and you might find one that has lots of little fish and another lake that maybe has a lower density of big fish. It's kind of part of the adventure for a lot of anglers.
And it'll vary year to year as populations grow or crash, right?
Yeah, or how long it's been since we've stocked a lake. So most of these lakes we don't stock every year. The Panhandle, we're typically stocking a lot of these lakes every other year, but in other parts of Idaho, it may even be less frequently. So the year after it gets stocked, you may go and have pretty good fishing in terms of your catch rates because there's a lot of fish. But by, say, the second or third year since we've stocked, there may be fewer fish because some have died. But the fish that are there may be bigger because they're a little older. So there's that dynamic as well.
Yeah, it's a real adventure. Andy, Idaho Fish and Game does a nice job of reporting where things are being stocked and the numbers and all that sort of thing. What's a good way for listeners to find out about stocking programs?
You bet. I would go to our Idaho Fish and Game website, which you can easily find just with a Google search. And then once you're on our website, two places in particular I would focus. One is under the fishing tab, you can go to fish stocking. And we have a stocking database, and you can go in and click on whatever region of the state you're interested in, and you can look at historical stocking records and see what we've stocked over the years or what we have planned for future stocking. And then another really good resource is what we call the fishing planner. And I think you can get to that just in the search window, or if you scroll all the way to the bottom of the homepage, there's a little icon that says fishing planner. And that's a great resource. You can type in whatever lake name you want, or you can type in what species of fish you're interested in catching, and it'll show you what lakes those fish are found in, what the fishing regulations are. It's just a whole bunch of information on there that's really helpful.
And I found it's very easy to use as well. It's a nice resource, and I appreciate it. That's a great, great resource, the Fish Planner. Phil, have we covered what we need to on the mountain lakes? Should we move to next topic?
I think so. Let's talk records.
You bet.
Well, what's interesting is that Idaho hasn't always had a catch and release record program, but we do now. And could you tell us a bit about it and how exciting it is?
Yeah. So, yeah, we've always had what we call certified weight records. And that's really the official records that that we've had for many, many years for different species of fish. And in order to qualify for one of those, you have to harvest the fish because it needs to be brought in and weighed on a certified scale. And, you know, there's that process involved that the fish has to be harvested. But here a few years ago, we decided to be maybe fun to diversify that records program and add this catch and release record program, which isn't designed to, you know, replace what we already had. But, you know, the certified weight record program, a lot of those records have been around a long time and they're really hard to break now. So it's not that frequent we get new entries. But we thought with a catch and release record program, it'd be just sort of a fun way to allow anglers to engage in that kind of activity, be able to release a fish, but still, you know, have the fun of having a record opportunity out of that. And so really what it involves is I think we started that program in 2016, so it's been a few years now that's been running. But if you go out fishing and you catch, let's say, a rainbow trout, when the program started, there were no entries. So everything was fair game. You could catch whatever size rainbow trout you wanted and you'd be the new record holder. And all you had to do was, and we've got a process on our website. Again, if you go to the fishing tab and go to record fish, you can look at all the rules. But basically you have to take a photo of the fish with some kind of measuring tape next to it so we can easily see how long the fish is. You have to have someone else who witnesses you catch the fish, because as we all know, anglers tend to catch things that are a little bigger than maybe they really are when they don't have somebody with them, right? So anyway, there's just a few of these very simple criteria. You submit your application, and if you have the longest fish of that species that's been caught, you're listed on our website. You have that catch and release record. And then if someone else comes along and breaks that record, we've been leaving the former record holder's name on the website. And so it just kind of keeps getting updated with new names, but it's just kind of a fun program for folks who want to go out and participate in that program. And it's generated a fair bit of interest. And yeah, I think it's been a success so far. And it seems like it's been even gaining interest here over the last year.
Boy, it seems like it. And there have been some big records after these 4 years. I noticed there was a new cutthroat record in the southern part of the state. I think it was a 31-incher.
Yeah. No, that's big. Right. I think that was just here in the last few weeks, I believe. And yeah, it was a tremendously big fish. And I knew you were going to ask about this program a little, so I actually looked at a few of the numbers, which I hadn't done for a while, and it was pretty intriguing. But for the Panhandle, the first year of the program in 2016, we had three record fish that were turned in. We had two in 2017, six in 2018, four in 2019, and seven in 2020 so far. So the current year has been the most we've had turned in. And of course, a number of those records have since been either by folks in our region or in other parts of the state. But I think it looked like we currently, in the Panhandle, have nine current records that are still at the top of the heap. So definitely some big fish getting caught in our part of the state. And it's been fun to see a lot of those folks turning those applications in.
You think as big as Padre is, it's going to grow some large fish. And I know it has, and it has a number of records. And so with a new program like this, Julie, there's an opportunity to go out and get your name in the record book.
It's possible, Phil. I could possibly catch the same fish that was a record a year ago, and he could be the new record. That's what's so great about catch and release.
Yeah,
that's right.
And
some of the records have come from Pondere. This year, I know the current bull trout record is from Pondere. It beat the previous one. Certainly, the Girard rainbow trout is from Pondere. So we've definitely got some big fish getting turned in from out there.
So it's fall.
That's pretty neat.
Doesn't every good fish turn to thoughts of spawning in the fall?
Well, I wouldn't say every good fish. There's actually a whole lot of fish in our part of the world that are spring spawners, but we got some pretty important fall spawners too. So maybe the one I'll start with is kokanee, just because those are pretty prominent in a lot of our waters. But yeah, and since we were just talking about Pondere, I guess I'll start there. We did our usual monitoring for of the kokanee population in August. And bottom line is that population continues to be very strong. We're seeing, you know, some of the highest densities of kokanee we've seen over the last several decades. So things are looking good there. We will be putting in a trap over at Granite Creek here in the next week or so and starting to operate that. And
Andy, what that means is you'll be collecting eggs, yes?
That's correct. And so those are eggs that we'll bring back to Cabinet Gorge Hatchery. And ultimately, those fish will get stocked back into the lake next June. And then there'll also be a lot of natural spawning occurring along the lake shore, especially in places like Scenic and Idlewild Bay down on the south end of the lake, but in some other areas as well. So yeah, we're expecting a good spawning run this year in Ponderay. And you know, another one I'll touch on is Coeur d'Alene Lake, just because that's popular with a lot of folks. Kokanee fishing on Coeur d'Alene was fantastic this year for bigger kokanee. Commonly there are smaller kokanee there, but the density of fish has been lower in the last couple of years. And so when there are fewer of them, again, they tend to get bigger. And so there were a lot of 14 to 17 inch kokanee in Coeur d'Alene this year and made for some really great fishing. But that will mean there are fewer of them that are actually spawning. And that for a lot of people means fewer eagles will likely be hanging out on Coeur d'Alene Lake than what you can usually go see, just because there are fewer dead kokanee that'll provide that food source for them. But with so many kokanee on Ponderay, I would expect that there'll be a lot of those eagles that'll be visible on Ponderay in places like Idlewild Bay and over at Granite Creek and things like that.
Yeah, I wouldn't think there'd be a shortage of eagle watching this year.
They'll still be around. They may just be in some different places. So
there you go. You know, bull trout are other important species that's spawning in the fall. What's happening with the bull trout?
Yeah, well, they're just wrapping up their spawning. And we do monitor bull trout by doing what we call red counts. So red is a spawning nest. So we go out and count those in different streams. And we just started doing that here over this week in the Ponderay streams. And over the next week or so, we'll be finishing that up. So I don't have any numbers for you yet, but from you know, what we're seeing so far, it looks like we should continue to have some pretty good numbers. Bull trout population in Ponderay is quite strong right now.
So that's good news.
While we're talking about various populations and all, how are some of the invasives doing, or how is the control measure on some of the invasives like walleye and northern pike going?
Yeah, so in Ponderay, we've certainly had a lot of attention focused on walleye in recent years, just because that population has been growing, and that's been of concern because that poses a threat to certainly kokanee, but also some of the other fish that we're managing for, like rainbow trout and bull trout. But we monitor that walleye population once every 3 years with a lake-wide survey that even includes surveying in the Ponderay River. And we just finished the most recent survey here over the last week. So in 2011, that was the first time we started doing that work. And then we repeated it in 2014 and 2017. And each time we did, the population was roughly doubling. And so around that time, we started doing some experimental walleye removal with a 3-week netting effort in the spring. And then more recently, we've added to that an angler incentive program for walleye to encourage angler harvest. And the goal is to try to keep that walleye population from continuing to grow at that fast rate, try to keep it at a low level, not with the intent of eliminating walleye, but trying to keep them from becoming too abundant and causing problems. The good news that we've seen from this most recent survey is that we did not see another increase in the population, and it actually has dropped a bit back to not quite as low as it was in 2014, but somewhere between where it was in 2014 and 2017. So anyway, I guess that's some real recent information I can share, and certainly is encouraging that some of the work going on to try to keep that population from expanding is hopefully having the impact that we would hope it would. And related to that, I guess I'll speak about the angler incentive program. So a lot of folks probably are aware what that is about, but bottom line, we have put little microscopic tags in the heads of walleye. They're not visible to anglers, but if you harvest a walleye, you can still keep the fillets and eat them. But if you remove the head and put them in the freezer locations we have around the lake, we'll then scan each of those heads. And if it has one of those tags in it, it's kind of like a lottery. Those tags are worth $1,000 a piece. So that's some pretty big money and a pretty big incentive for folks to harvest walleye that they may catch, or even just to go walleye fishing if they're on the fence about what they want to go fish for on a given day. And we've had good participation in that program. And we had, I think this year so far, we've had about 550 walleye caught so far. And of those, I think we're at 11 lucky winners who have won the $1,000 reward. So
all right,
it's been pretty cool for a lot of folks.
That is really neat, Andy. It makes for a fun fishing experience, a little bit of a adventure in addition to your walleye fishing. I'm wondering if you have any sense of which part of the control program is the most effective, if it's your netting program that you with Fish and Game are doing, or if it is the angler participation.
Well, I think it's early to say. I mean, and I can't even say exactly how much of the, you know, what looks to be a decline in the walleye population is attributed to netting versus angling versus just natural fluctuation in the population. But certainly there is likely effect going on from the work that's happening. I would say if it's anything like what we've seen with the lake trout suppression program we've had ongoing out there, the combination of the two is what really has been helpful. And the goal is to try to maximize mortality. And having some of that netting along with angling has been a good combined approach.
Yeah, neat. Now, I'm seeing a lot of pictures of big northern pike as well, and that's angler participation. I'm hoping people are removing them. I know not everyone is. Tell us briefly what's happening with northern pike.
Well, there are more northern pike out there than there were, especially over the last 5 years or so. We've really seen those numbers increase, but not to the same extent we have with walleye. But there have been plenty of good angling opportunities, and some of these pike have been really large fish, 20 pounds or bigger, you know. And so we don't have the same type of program in place for them with an angler incentive program or anything, but certainly it's another species that we're watching because it does have potential to, threaten some of the species that we are managing for out there.
Sure.
So that's one we're keeping an eye on, I guess.
Okay, sounds good. And you're right about there being some trophy-sized northern being collected. There are some pretty neat pictures out there. Andy, this isn't your main area. I know it, because you're up here in the Panhandle and we're not really a steelhead salmon region, but it sounds like there's some promising reports coming in, or relatively promising reports coming in about the steelhead season. Are you able to touch on that?
I can a little bit. Steelhead fishing has not been a real hotspot here the last few years because the runs have been really small at really historically low levels, to the point where last year the season was actually closed for a good chunk of time, and for several years now the limit has been reduced from what it typically had been. So I guess the good news so far this year is that the run forecast is improved from the last several years, and the forecast in the Clearwater River is, I believe, on track to be the third or fourth best return over the last 10 years. So certainly better than where we've been here recently, and the run in the salmon and snake is also looking much better as well. And so certainly not where we put it in terms of it being a great steelhead return, but better than where we've been for at least the last few years.
So when we put all this together, I know it's hard to have that crystal ball, but what is the general prognosis for our area's fisheries look like going into 2021?
Back to the Panhandle here.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I guess I would say it's really good. I mean, we certainly have a lot of tremendous fishery resources here, and the Panhandle, I think, is we have the advantage of having lots of water. You know, Idaho has, I think, 30% of the surface water, and the state of Idaho is in the Panhandle region. So we've got a lot of water to work with, which means we've got a lot of fish, and we also have a lot of diversity. We've got everything from, you know, great trout fishing in both rivers and lakes to great warm water fishing for things like smallmouth bass and, you know, largemouth bass and things of that nature. So if you're an angler in the Panhandle, I think you got an awful lot of opportunity. And yeah, certainly not all our fisheries are performing at the level we'd like, but an awful lot of them are doing pretty darn well.
Excellent.
That's really good news. Well, have we missed anything for our fall update, Andy?
I think those are the, those are some of the highlights, I think. And I guess I would just encourage folks, if there's anything we hit on that you have more interest in, like I said, our website's a great source of information. And you're also certainly welcome at any time to give any of our fishery staff a call here in the regional office.
Well, as always, we sure appreciate you coming on. If anything comes up that you want to address specifically between now and spring, let us know. We'll have you back on.
Yeah, anytime. It's always enjoyable.
Yes, for us too. Well, I want to thank you, Andy Ducks, Regional Fishery Manager for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, for joining Phil and me today and giving us an update on everything going on up here in the Panhandle. I think it's got Phil thinking about fishing some mountain lakes next year. We'll see. For those of you joining us, this has been Community Conversations, the alternative to the normal KRFY morning show here at 88.5 FM. Thank you for joining us this week.